The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I want to do a little introduction to our interview this morning, give you some of the backstory here. Otto Penzler is a legendary figure, and if you've never heard of him, you're really in for a treat when you find out what Otto has done and what he's still doing. And I've always wanted to interview him, and I finally got an opportunity thanks to Lawrence Block, who we had on the program earlier this year. Lawrence is a very well-known novelist, and he lives in New York City, but at one time he was a student at Antioch College, and the first time I ever interviewed Lawrence was about 20 years ago, and he was in Yellow Springs, and he came by and did an interview. And I talked to him again about 10 years ago, about every 10 years I track him down, and he had a new novel out this year called Dead Girl Blues, and we had a very nice conversation about it. And you can listen to that interview if you go to our website at wyso.org and look for Lawrence Block, Dead Girl Blues. And Lawrence is very active on Twitter, amazingly. Lawrence is on there frequently and very funny, very humorous. And I'm on Twitter a little bit. You can follow me at BookNookVic. And recently, Lawrence was on there, and he was talking about the Mysterious Bookshop, which is a legendary bookstore in Manhattan, owned by Otto Penzler. And we got into a little conversation on Twitter, and I mentioned how I would love to interview Otto. And he said, well, you should. He'd be great. He would love to be interviewed. And I said, really? And so I went into Twitter, and I looked up the Mysterious Bookshop. Now, Otto doesn't do Twitter, but he's got employees who do. And I sent a tweet to an employee, and I said, I'd really like to interview Otto. Is that possible? And they wrote me right back, and they said, sure, here's his email address. So then I had a long email exchange with Otto. And he said, your timing is very good because I have a new collection coming out called The Big Book of Espionage, and I'd love to talk to you about it. And he was so kind. And when the time came for this interview, I was so nervous. I usually don't get nervous, but with Otto Penzler on the phone, finally, after all these years, I was so nervous, and he was so wonderful to talk to. Let's listen now to my interview with Otto Penzler on the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest on the show today is Otto Penzler. He joins us on the telephone in Manhattan. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Otto, it's been a dream of mine to interview you, and I'm actually just almost speechless with delight.
I'm so happy to make your dreams come true.
Otto, you have a book that came out that you put together, I believe it was last week. It's called The Big Book of Espionage, the most complete compendium of double agents, dead drops, and duplicitous deeds ever collected. And I just got this book just a day or two ago, and so I wasn't able to read the entire thing, but you suggested that I should read a guy named, is it Charles McCary?
I did.
Yeah.
He's not just a guy. I have to tell you, he is, in my view, and you know, and I've been in the world of mystery now for half a century. I think he's the greatest espionage writer that America ever produced. And reviews over the years have constantly called him the American John le Carré.
Hmm.
And I prefer to think of John le Carré as the British Charles McCary.
Well, I did read The Hand of Carlos, and I didn't notice that you had a second story by him, which certainly is a good indication how much you like him, because isn't he the only one that got two stories in this collection?
He is, yes. in most of the anthologies, and I've done, just as an aside, I've done 14 of these big books for Random House Vintage. And this is the 14th, and I try really hard in all of those books to use one story by an author, because otherwise it's too easy to find a favorite writer and use 2, 3, 4, 5 stories by the same writer. I did make an exception a couple of years ago. I did a book called The Big Book of Real Murders, R-E-E-L.
Mm.
And they were stories that inspired great mystery movies. And I think I used 8 stories by Cornell Woolrich, who had about 30 films made from his stories, most famously Rear Window, but many other really outstanding stories and sometimes really good movies.
Your introductions are so informative for each of these stories that you give us a page-long history, a bio of these writers, and so many of them are legendary, of course. Your Ian Flemings, your Conan Doyles, and then we've got some younger sprouts coming up, people like Olin Steinhauer, who I greatly admire.
Yeah, so do I. And there are, in addition to younger writers, there are some very obscure older writers that I write about, too. In a couple of cases, I couldn't find out very much about them, and so the introductions were kind of short. I got into this situation years ago when the very first book I did with Vintage, I wrote these introductions, and I didn't know that they were going to insist that I do that for every book after that. It took a lot of time for many of these to do serious research to find information about some of the lesser known writers, although sometimes the hardest ones were occurred when the writer is really famous, and like a Stephen King or an Agatha Christie or an Arthur Conan Doyle, when there's so much available, how do you sort of boil it down to a single page? But I've had a lot of compliments on those introductions, and that kind of become the trademark of that series. And a lot of reviews have said that, you know, they prefer the introductions to the stories, which is a little too flattering, I think. And
well,
not true, and shouldn't be true.
I was intrigued by how many of these writers, when we read their bio, we would discover that 100 years ago, this author was the biggest name in the world, and we're going, who is this guy? Oh, he wrote the screenplay for King Kong. It's like, I never heard of this guy.
Edgar Wallace,
yeah.
the great line about him, and I've never verified this, but I've read it in several places, is that there was a 10-year period in the 1920s where 1 out of every 4 books of fiction sold in the United Kingdom were written by Edgar Wallace.
Amazing.
Just extraordinary.
It's The Big Book of Espionage, edited by Otto Penzler, who joins me on the program today. Otto, I would love to share with our listeners who you are, because you are an amazing guy, and you've done so many things. Can you give us a little bio of yourself?
Sure. I mean, where it's pertinent, I started a publishing company called The Mysterious Press in 1975, 45 years ago. It still exists. For the last 9 years, it's been an imprint at Grove Atlantic, and for 10 years before that, at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And starting in 2021, I will take over full responsibility for that company again. I've published under that imprint so many major names: P.D. James and Ruth Rendell, Charles Beccari, Len Dayton, Eric Ambler, James Ellroy, pretty much every, that's an exaggeration, but a huge percentage of the major writers of the last half century. Shortly after Mysterious Press, I opened the Mysterious Bookshop in Manhattan. We celebrated in April of this year our 41st anniversary. we're located in Tribeca, which is downtown Manhattan. And in the last couple of years, I've started three new publishing companies. One is American Mystery Classics, where we're reissuing in hardcover and trade paperback the great detective writers of the 20s, 30s, and 40s of the Golden Age, what is called the Golden Age, which is that generally that period between the two world wars. We also created, just started a new company publishing Malice, covering domestic suspense and psychological suspense, called Scarlet. Our first three books came out in September, October, November, all of which have had great reviews in the New York Times, as well as trade journals like Publishers Weekly and Book List and so on. About 10 years ago, I started MysteriousPress.com, which is an e-publishing company. And it was really important to know that I'm a technological moron. I know nothing about technology. I am hopeless. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was run a technical publishing company. But I was pushed into it by my agent, and now we publish about 1,800 mystery titles from the Golden Age, from modern times. So many of the greatest writers have books with us at MysteriousPress.com. And I'm glad I did it. It's been very successful. When we were closed down in New York, when the bookshop was forced to shut its doors, ebooks did extremely well because people were hunkered down in their homes, you know, and they were doing a lot of reading and really couldn't go out to bookstores very much to do their usual browsing. And so MysteriousPress.com sold a lot of books. I've done about 70 anthologies. I was guest editor. I was the series editor for Best American Mystery Stories of the Year for 24 years. I did a lot of other anthologies as well. So I've been keeping busy.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest on the program today is Otto Penzler. And we're talking about The Big Book of Espionage, the most complete compendium of double agents, dead drops, and duplicitous deeds ever collected. And there's a lot more to talk about, and I'll continue my conversation with Otto right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO and my conversation with Otto Penzler. Did you say the ebook imprint has 1,800 titles?
1,800 titles, yeah, maybe 1,900. I haven't kept an accurate count.
Well,
but it published Dashiell Hammett and James M. Cain, James Ellroy. We published Donald Westlake, Ellis Peters, you know, great medieval mysteries. Reginald Hill. We published the Nero Wolfe books by Robert Goldsboro. Published Ellery Queen. It's a big company and. Really, you know, just so many really good books. It's a great website. All you have to do is look at MysteriousPress.com, and you'll see all the titles that we've got. It's a huge number.
Would it be apt to describe you as having a mysterious obsession?
Well, it's I guess so. I did write a little book, what I call my little bibliomemoir, called Mysterious Obsession. But it was only published in the bookshop, in my bookshop. It's not, you can't buy it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon, if you'll excuse the language. One of my colleagues here is the person who suggested that I write it. Because I collected books. I've collected mystery first editions, mystery crime suspense, you know, in its broad definition, for more than 50 years. And formed arguably the greatest library of first editions in that field ever assembled. And I was putting it all up for auction, Now that I've reached a certain age and have no family, it seemed time to do that. And so I brought my staff up to my house to see the library. And we walked through the shelves, and I pull off books and tell them, you know, little stories about them, why this was a particularly interesting book, why I particularly liked this book, how I acquired it, how it became part of my collection, and so on. And at the end of the tour, my colleague said, I have an idea. Why don't I come up another weekend? I'll take photos of these books that you told these stories about, and then you write what you discussed with us.
Uh-huh.
And I did. And turned into a beautiful little book, full color photos, and the frontispiece, which is a photo of my library, which was so beautiful, I have to say. So yeah, that's we've gone to three printings for that book. I keep thinking that this is so specific. You know, only a collector would really be interested, somebody who really loved first editions and was a total bibliomaniac would like this book, but it keeps selling. So we've gone through three printings.
Can you give me some examples of some of the books that you had in your collection and why they were special and where you got them?
Well, I've added, it was 60,000 books. The collection got to be insane. I mean, and frankly, I don't recommend it because it takes over your life, you know, to do it properly. I never cataloged them. There were too many books, and they came in because I have a bookshop, remember. They came in pretty fast, sometimes in large quantities. And I kept upgrading to make them better and better copies, exchanging just a first edition for an autographed first edition, that sort of thing. But, you know, any major book in this field that you can think of was in my collection.
Oh, man.
So take The Maltese Falcon. The story that I tell about that is that I bought a copy from somebody who was selling it, a customer who was selling the book, and I bought it. And I had two mistresses, as it were. One was the bookshop, and one was my collection. And so I would buy a book, and if I knew I needed it for my collection, it went on the shelf, and it was never sold. I never sold a book from my collection.
Mm.
If I didn't need it for any reason, it went to the bookshop, and then it never found its way onto my shelves. I just went into the bookshop. But my desk was kind of the DMZ. it's where I would put a book while I was thinking about whether I could add it to my collection or not.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, unfortunately, it was, and I take no pride in this, but I didn't have very much money. I never had very much money. And so there were some really wonderful books that I couldn't buy because I couldn't afford them. But I bought this Maltese Falcon, and it was sitting on my desk, and I didn't have one. And obviously, it's one of the great cornerstones of any collection. And my wife came by, and she said, oh, what a beautiful copy. Is this yours or the store's? And I said, I don't know. You know, I paid a lot of money for it. We can't really afford it.
Mm.
And she said, but you don't have one, right? I said, no. And she said, how could you have a great collection without a copy of The Maltese Falcon?
Mm.
What a great wife. So I immediately picked it up, put it on the shelf, and figured out how we were going to pay the rent later.
Wow. Well, I have to thank Lawrence Block, who suggested to me that I try to get an interview with you, Otto. And he told me about this book of yours, Mysterious Obsession, because apparently he's using some of it in a compilation that he's working on.
He bought a copy and was very, very generous in his praise of the book. And indeed liked it so much that he's using it in his own book, which really is about as flattering as you can get.
Well, Lawrence had his own collection, which he also parted with finally. He was a stamp collector. And
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, he decided. Well, again, you know, when you reach a certain age, the prospect of what do you do with these things that you've collected for so long?
Mm.
In the off chance that you die, what happens to it? You know, and so, and that was my concern when I was selling my books. It's like, wait a minute, if something by some wild chance I don't live forever, what's going to happen to these books? And so I put them up for auction. There have been several auctions now. And, you know, it's hard to part with it, but at some point you have to make an adult decision.
What I wonder when I hear you describe your experiences with this collection is, now that you've parted with these beloved items, have you started collecting something else?
No.
Okay.
You know, when you've had the greatest collection in the world, it's really hard to start at an advanced age because you don't put together great collections in overnight.
Okay.
You know, it takes a lot of time. It takes research. It takes dedication. It takes obsession.
Mm.
It takes obsession. And I just can't imagine doing it. I think about it all the time because, I think we're born with either that collecting gene. We either have it or we don't. And I must, because I've collected something or other ever since I was a child. And I think about it, but there's nothing that makes sense to me yet. I haven't quit on the idea, but I have nothing at the moment. Let me take that back.
Okay.
Let me just take that back.
All right.
I said I sold everything. I didn't. I kept my reference books because I value them and I use them all the time. I also kept my anthologies because I do anthologies. I edit anthologies for other publishing companies, and so they're a valuable source. So I maintained all of those. But I also kept a tiny little collection. My first reading in mystery fiction, that was after I graduated college. I didn't read mysteries as a child.
Mm-hmm.
It was later, and my first passion was Sherlock Holmes. And then when Sherlock Holmes' stories pretty much ended at an early time, the character who became the most popular character in England, in mystery fiction in England, was Raffles, Gentleman Jewel Thief.
Oh.
And so I started reading those. And so I started collecting Raffles. I was just taken by this gentleman, the bon vivant, who at nighttime would be a safecracker. And I thought they were really charming. And so I started collecting Raffles, and nobody else collected them. And so I have a couple of hundred various editions of Raffles, including letters and inscribed books and so on. And so I kept that collection. I don't think most people would care too much about it, so it wasn't going to be a really hot item at the auction house anyway.
Mm.
But that's my one collecting interest, except I can't find anything because I have so much in that collection. And it's so small, there were only four books.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Otto Penzler. He joins us on the phone today in New York City. And Otto, I know you've had a lot of book signing events in your store over the years, and I'm guessing that you've met a ton of writers. And I just was wondering if I could talk to you about some of the people that you've met over the years. I've interviewed a lot of crime novelists. In fact, the number one guy on my list I've interviewed 19 times, a guy named James Lee Burke. And just love him.
Oh, Jim is one of the most interesting, colorful people that I know. Unfortunately, he doesn't travel anymore.
Uh-huh.
The very early years of the Mysterious Bookshop, he did, but he won't fly anymore. But yeah, he came to the store, and he was great fun. I know his daughter extremely well, and got to know her quite well for a while. But yeah, and you know, because my bookshop used to be in Midtown Manhattan. It was on 56th Street, right behind Carnegie Hall. And so everybody sooner or later, every writer sooner or later comes to New York, whether they're touring or whether they just wanted to meet with their agent or their editor, almost all of whom are in New York. So they would come, and the bookshop became like Rick's Cafe American in Casablanca. Uh-huh. Everybody comes to Rick's. Well, everybody came to Otto's. So, yeah, I made great friends. I mean, among the people who were there were John Le Carré, P.D. James would come every other year, Ruth Rendell, Donald Westlake, Joseph Wambaugh, James Ellroy, just name somebody. And if they were alive and active in the past 40 years, they pretty much have come to the store to sign books for us.
Did you ever get Charles Williford?
Charles Williford, of course. Yeah, he came several times. And had an interesting thing. He sent me a manuscript and asked me what I thought of it. And I told him that he really needed to make some changes. And one of them was the title.
Right.
And it was his first Hoke Mosley book. And it was titled A Necklace of Hickeys. And I said, Charles, that's not going to work. You need to change that. And, of course, it became Miami Blues, uh-huh. And he became very successful. We had a great correspondence, and he came to the store for three books in a row. Hmm. And then, this is a poignant story, he came by, and he had just made a really big money deal. For the first time in his life, he actually made money. And he came by to tell me about it. And I said, I'm so happy for you. This is so great and so deserved. And he said, it's too late. I said, no, come on. You're still writing. You're strong. He said, no, I've been diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, no.
And I only have a few months to go.
Oh.
It's just so sad.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, but Charlie was just a lovely, lovely guy and a wonderful writer, as I know you know.
Well, speaking of that kind of situation, I had an interview scheduled a couple years ago with a guy who was one of my all-time favorites, and they said he's not touring this year, but he'll call you from London. And then a week before the interview was scheduled, he died, Philip Kerr.
Oh, yeah. I was so sad. He was relatively young.
Uh-huh.
He came to the store on a pretty regular basis, and the last time he was here, he got here, he sort of misread his schedule or something, so he got here like an hour early, and so we went off to my office and we just chatted for an hour until it became time to go to the party. A very colorful, interesting man, really a bright, colorful guy.
He was wonderful.
What a writer. Oh, yeah. What a great series.
That Bernie Gunther was my favorite. Now I'm looking for new favorites. Do you ever talk to any of the Scandinavians? Someone like Nesbø, does he come through?
Joe Nesbø comes, yeah. I think he's the best of the Scandinavians. He's my favorite of the Scandinavians. He's certainly the darkest.
Uh-huh.
Those books are really dark. But Henning Mankell used to come to the store.
Oh, my.
Camilla Läckberg has been in the store. And we see on a regular basis, in fact, he has written our little Christmas book, Ragnar Jonasson.
Oh, he's great. He's
the Icelandic writer. He every year at my bookshop, we commission an original short story.
Mm-hmm.
And the author has to have three elements in the story. It has to have an element of mystery. It has to be set at Christmas time. And it has to at least be partially set in the mysterious bookshop. And we've done this for over 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And then we print it in a little chapbook, which we give to our customers as a Christmas present.
Oh, that's lovely.
So, yeah, so Ragnar, very kindly wrote A Christmas Puzzle as the title of the story. And it's a wonderful, real old-fashioned detective story with real clues.
I've had him on the show, and he's amazing.
And he's actually a bit of a collector, and he buys some rare books from us from time to time.
Mm. Well, I know he kind of started off translating Agatha Christie into Icelandic.
Right, yeah. My Sjöwall and Per Valu, they were really the first of the Scandinavian writers in the mystery world to be, of any significance anyway, to be translated into English, and they became quite successful.
I love that series.
It was a really good series. You know, the odd story about it is Per Valu only agreed. He said, "I'll only write 10 mm-hmm. of these with you." He told my Sjöwall he'd only write 10, and when they finished the 10th, he died within months
right.
after finishing the last book.
Wow.
You know, and of course, everybody says, should have said 20.
Otto. Well, I see we're running out of time here, Otto, and I really appreciate you appearing on the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm so glad that you invited me, and I wish you a happy Thanksgiving, or is this airing too late? Sorry.
That's fine. We'll have Thanksgiving tomorrow as we're recording this, and we'll air this probably in a week or two. And
okay,
just
great.
Happy holidays, generic happy holidays. And
thanks so much.
Don't go away. I've got a special Book Nook bonus segment coming your way, and we're going to look a little more deeply into this collection by Otto Penzler, The Big Book of Espionage, and I'm going to talk about the time I met Otto Penzler 13 years ago. He wouldn't remember it, but I certainly do, right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with a little bonus segment for you. I want to talk about Otto Penzler, who was my guest on the program today, and what an amazing guy. He's a publisher. He edits all these anthologies. He's a writer. He has this amazing bookstore. He had the most incredible collection of crime fiction on the planet, and they're still auctioning off those books. I was just checking them out the other day online. And he was talking about The Big Book of Espionage and the introductions that he wrote for these writers. And these are really beautiful, beautiful introductions. And I'd like to share some of that work with you right now. Here's one for a writer named Captain A.O. Pollard for his story, Under Enemy Colors. Almost entirely forgotten today, except by collectors of crime and espionage fiction, Captain Alfred Oliver Pollard, 1893-1860, was once an enormously prolific writer of spy and adventure novels, producing 46 novels in those genres, published between 1930 and 1962, as well as short stories and nonfiction, notably books about military deeds and history, including Fire Eater, The Memoirs of a VC, 1932, an autobiography focused on his military career, in which he makes it obvious that he enjoyed the fighting, especially the killing of the enemy. Pollard volunteered for service in the British Army in 1914 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant in 1914 in the Honorable Artillery Company. He saw combat frequently, being wounded twice, but returned to battle almost immediately both times. His extraordinary bravery on the front lines earned Britain's highest honors, including the Victoria Cross, and he is reported to have been England's most decorated soldier of the Great War. His first book, Purdale Island, 1930, and other of his earliest titles were crime stories. He soon turned to thrillers, pitting British soldiers and agents against the Nazis, and when that war was settled, turned his heroic characters against those from the Soviet Union. Among his other fiction, Pollard wrote science fiction novels in which he introduced inventions created by the villains, designed to be used for evil purposes. In The Murder Germ, 1937, for example, a mad scientist infects innocent people with a concoction that causes them to commit unspeakable acts that mirror his own. Virtually all of his books carry the byline that includes his rank. And another introduction that he's got is for a very famous American writer named Ambrose Bierce. And the story he picked is called The Story of a Conscience. It seems that the entire life of Ambrose Gwinnett Bierce, 1842 to 1914, and every word he wrote was dark and cynical, earning him the sobriquet Bitter Bierce. It is not surprising that his greatest success came in the dark world of supernatural fiction, where he has been described as America's greatest writer of horror fiction between Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft. Born in Meigs County, Ohio, he grew up in Indiana with his mother, an eccentric father, as the 10th of 13 children, all of whose names began with the letter A. When the Civil War broke out, he volunteered and was soon commissioned a first lieutenant in the Union Army, seeing action in the Battle of Shiloh. He became one of the most important and influential journalists in America, writing columns for William Randolph Hearst's San Francisco Examiner. His darkest book may be the devastating The Devil's Dictionary, 1911, in which he defined a saint as a dead sinner, revised and edited, befriend as to make an ingrate, and birth as the first and direst of all tragedies. His most famous story is probably an occurrence at Owl's Creek Bridge, in which a condemned prisoner believes he has been reprieved just before the rope snaps his neck. It was filmed three times and was twice made for television by Rod Serling for The Twilight Zone and by Alfred Hitchcock for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. In 1913, he accompanied Pancho Villa's army as an observer. He wrote a letter to a friend dated December 26, 1913. He then vanished. One of the most famous disappearances in history, once as famous as those of Judge Crater and Amelia Earhart. One of Otto's introductions from the Big Book of Espionage. And this is an enormous book, and I'm still reading it. I didn't get the book until the day before the interview, so I was so excited about talking to Otto Penzler. I would have interviewed him just to talk about his book collection, if nothing else. And the reason that I know Otto, that I even have heard of Otto, is because of a conference that I used to go to. It's called Book Expo America. And there are a lot of changes happening in publishing right now. On the day I interviewed Otto, it was announced that more consolidation is taking place in the publishing industry. The biggest American publisher, Penguin Random House, which became that big because of a merger between those imprints a few years ago, announced that they were getting ready to buy the third largest publisher, Simon & Schuster. And if that merger goes through, they will be publishing probably a third of all the books in the United States. It's been a hard year for publishers. Even though Simon & Schuster made a profit this year, they are being sold by Viacom. And Bertelsmann, a conglomerate in Germany, which owns Random House and Penguin, looks like they're going to acquire another big publishing house. You have to wonder if that's good for publishing. We'll see. Book Expo America was the big yearly publishing conference. They held it in various locations, quite often in New York City. I went to my first Book Expo in 2004 in Chicago. My good friend Bill Young met me in Chicago and took me around Book Expo. And we had an amazing time. Bill is a media escort in Chicago. When an author comes to Chicago, quite often it's Bill who drives them around, picks them up at the airport, takes them to their hotel, takes them to the bookstore, takes them out to eat. Bill knows everybody, and he has been my guide at many book expos. And that first one in 2004 is memorable because he got me into several really interesting situations. Suffice it to say, we had drinks with Gene Hackman And then later that evening, we had dinner with David Sedaris and some very interesting conversations. 3 years later, Book Expo was held in Los Angeles. And this was really interesting to me. You'd walk around the floor of Book Expo, and you'd look over there, and Alec Baldwin would be standing there talking about his new memoir. You'd walk around the corner, here's Barbara Walters talking to Dr. Ruth Westheimer. You go downstairs, there's a signing line. My friend Bill says, ignore the line. Let's walk around the back. We walk through the back to what they called their green room. It was just an area with chairs and green walls. And here was Jamie Lee Curtis saying some very blue words, saying some, she was angry about something. And we walked by and she was just going on and on about this and that and swearing. And that was very interesting to me. And then we walked behind the curtain and came out, and here was Hustler publisher Larry Flint in his gold wheelchair. And Bill said, hi, Larry. And Larry said, oh, hi, Bill. And at the table next to him, here was Ernest Borgnine signing autographs. And it was just very interesting to be at Book Expo. And we were walking along. We saw a very distinguished-looking fellow walking along with white hair. And Bill said, do you know who that guy is? I said, no, I don't recognize him. He says, that's Otto Penzler. He's a legend. And he introduced me to Otto, and I'm sure Otto doesn't remember it. Well, later that evening, we went to a party at Larry King's house in Beverly Hills. Oprah's people were there. It was a birthday party for Ted Turner. This is what Book Expo was all about in Los Angeles. All these famous people. Later on that night, there was a party at the home of the artist formerly known as Prince. But I didn't go because it was past my bedtime. The following night, there was a birthday party for Michael Connelly. And all the LA crime writers were there. And I hitched a ride with one of my favorite L.A. crime novelists, Robert Craze. And Robert took me across Los Angeles and gave me a guided tour. He'd point at a building and say, that's the Los Angeles Police Department. Or he'd drive by an alley and go, that looks like a great place to hide a body. Robert is amazing. He took me to the party, and here was Michael Connelly and all these other L.A. crime writers, and then holding court in the corner was Otto Penzler. And I asked my friend Bill, I said, so what is it about Otto? He says, well, he says, he's published all of these writers in one form or another. He has this amazing bookstore. All these writers have gone there. He has this incredible book collection, unlike any other book collection. Thousands and thousands of books, first editions. And I thought, gee, that's amazing. I would love to interview someone like him someday. Well, I finally fulfilled my dream by talking to Otto Penzler in the book nook for the Big Book of Espionage. And it was a lot easier than I expected. I really did not expect that Otto would be available that easily. And I've got to thank Lawrence Block for telling me to do that, to try it. And it paid off, and it didn't hurt when I emailed Otto and said, Larry Block suggested that I should call you. So I've had a lot of fun at the book expos over the years, and it was kind of heartbreaking when I heard this week a press release, and it stated, U.S. Book Publishing's biggest trade show is being retired. Show organizer Reed Pop announced today, Book Expo will not be held in 2021. Given the continued uncertainty surrounding in-person events at this time, the company has decided that the best way forward is to retire the current iteration of events as they explore new ways to meet the community's needs through a fusion of in-person and virtual events. In order to try to hold the event earlier this year, Reed moved the date from its usual spot at New York City's Javits Center in late May to late July. But as the coronavirus continued to make larger meetings impossible, Reed canceled the live conference and held 6 days of free virtual programming from May 26th through 31st. The pandemic arrived at a time in the life cycle of Book Expo where we were already examining the restructure of our events to best meet our community's needs. This has led us to make the difficult decision to retire the events in their current formats as we take the necessary time to evaluate the best way to move forward and rebuild our events that will better serve the industry and reach more people than we were able to before. Their convention business has been hammered by COVID-19, down 70% this year. Not a good year to have a convention. You remember the Republican convention that was supposed to be in North Carolina, and then they moved it to Florida, and then it became a virtual convention. Not a good year for that. Not a good year for publishing. Not a good year for lots of people getting together in large groups. And it's kind of heartbreaking to have the Book Expo canceled, apparently forever, because I had so much fun. The first year I went in 2004, I went as a publicist for a local author. I was there in a booth handing out copies of a book by an author from Yellow Springs. That was my first experience. The next year, I went with a placard from the Dayton Daily News as a book reviewer. And I always paid my own way and had a wonderful time. I never felt any guilt eating cold cuts with David Sedaris or letting Gene Hackman buy me another drink. That Gene Hackman story, wow, that was amazing. My friend Bill Young took us to pick up Gene Hackman at his hotel. We walked over to the bookstore, and we did a book signing. And I sat there in a chair, and there was a uniformed Chicago police officer who was checking out all the people looking for autographs. And there were all these eBay guys waiting in line with stacks of movie stills of Gene Hackman, and he would very graciously sign all of them. Very kind, never got upset. Guy'd be sitting there with 20 photos to sign, and he would sign them all. And then after it was over, the policeman walked up to me. I'd been sitting in a nice, comfortable chair up by the front. And the policeman came up to me and he said, "It's really been great working with you." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Aren't you Gene Hackman's bodyguard?" I said, "No." I said, "Oh," he said, "Well, you look like it. You're a big guy. And you're just sitting there kind of watching everybody." I said, "I assumed you were his bodyguard." So after that, we walked out on the street to go back to Gene's hotel. It was a beautiful day along Lakeshore Drive. And we were walking along, and people kept turning, pedestrians. They'd see Gene Hackman, and they'd turn, and they'd do a double take. And I was standing behind him, swaggering like a good bodyguard, doing my job. And we got to the hotel, and Gene said, "Well, why don't you come in and have a drink?" And he was staying at a really nice hotel. I think it was called the Drake. And we went in and we went into the bar and it was packed. And there was quite a buzz as I walked in there with a Hollywood movie star, his editor, Gene Hackman's lovely wife, and Bill, Mr. Chicago, my media escort friend. And I sat there very quietly, like the fly on the wall. And at one point, Gene Hackman turned to me, and he was talking about Cormac McCarthy. And he looked at me, and he said, So, "What do you think of the trilogy?" And I was so stunned and astonished that he had actually spoken to me directly, that for once in my life, I was speechless. I'm going to miss Book Expo. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.